The car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
You might know him as one of America's, well, let's say worst presidents. Mm-hmm. That name, Orrin G. Harding, often pops up alongside words like scandal and failure.
Right. But here's the twist. What if we told you that during his time in office, he was actually one of the most popular presidents in U.S. history?
Exactly. It's a real contradiction. Mm-hmm. So today we're taking a deep dive into the fascinating and, yeah, often contradictory life of Orrin G. Harding, the 29th president of the United States.
It's quite a story. You've got this layer cake of initial public adoration, then this incredibly swift, dramatic historical decline.
Why now?
And now even some, you know, serious reassessments by historians. Our mission with this deep dive is really to sift through all those complex layers.
Okay.
From Harding's pretty humble Ohio beginnings, his surprising rise to power, right up to the sudden kind of tragic end of his presidency.
And everything that came out after.
The posthumous revelations that just irrevocably shaped his legacy. We're here to extract the most important nuggets, uncover some maybe surprising facts, and help you understand how one person's reputation can be so dramatically rewritten by history.
Absolutely. We've gathered quite a bit of material on Harding, his personal life, which is eventful.
To say the least.
His journey from being a small town newspaper editor all the way to the White House.
Right.
We'll look at his policy achievements and, yes, let's be honest, his significant stumbles too.
And the infamous scandals, of course. The ones that really only blew up after he died.
Right. So we'll explore that initial public love he had, then the steep decline in how history viewed him, and these more recent efforts by historians to maybe see his complex record in a new light.
And this isn't just, you know, a dry historical biography. It's really a look at how leadership, public perception, political maneuvering, even, well, personal flaws, foibles, exactly, how all that can truly define a presidency. It's a powerful illustration of how time and new information coming to light can completely change how we understand someone from the past.
So get ready to maybe challenge some assumptions and discover the man behind the myths that have stuck to him for, well, for decades now.
Yeah.
Let's start at the beginning. Not just a birthplace, but maybe the crucible that forged the man who would become president. Orrin G. Harding's early life in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a rich tapestry of experiences that, looking back, clearly shaped his unique path.
Definitely. Born Orrin Gamaliel Harding, November 2, 1865, in rural Blooming Grove, Ohio, eldest of eight kids. Apparently his family called him Winnie.
Winnie. Okay. So what was it about those roots that, you know, set him apart or pointed him towards this future?
Well, his family background was pretty diverse. His father, George Tryon Harding, they called him Tryon. He was a farmer, a school teacher, later even a doctor.
Wow, busy guy.
Right. And his mother, Phoebe Elizabeth, was a state-licensed midwife. So you have this grounding in, like, rural practicality, but also a broader social awareness. They were also abolitionists, which is significant for the time.
And their ancestry.
Also quite diverse, traced back to England, but also Welsh, Scottish, and even some Dutch roots from a wealthy family called Van Kirk. So this environment probably gave him an understanding of different kinds of people, different social strata, and definitely a sense of community.
So a foundation of maybe practical skills and a relatively progressive outlook for the era. And from these humble beginnings, he pretty quickly developed a nose for news, literally.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. By age 11, he's already learning the ropes of the newspaper business. He worked for his father's weekly paper, The Argus, in Caledonia. That's where the family moved in 1870.
When he was a good student, too.
Seems so, yeah. A Depp student at Ohio Central College, enrolled when he was just 14. And during his final year there, he even co-published a small local paper, The Iberia Spectator. Graduated in 1882, moved to Marion, Ohio.
This early deep dive into journalism, that feels really significant, doesn't it?
It's profoundly significant. I mean, think about it. To this day, Harding is the only U.S. president with full-time journalism experience.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Only one.
Only one. And it's not just a trivia point. It fundamentally shaped how he communicated, how he understood public opinion, his whole approach to politics. He learned how to you know, read the pulse of a community, how to craft messages that landed.
And he was involved in the community beyond the paper, too.
Oh, yeah. Joined the Free Baptist Church in Marion in 1883, served as a trustee for 25 years, stayed a member his whole life. Seems like that community connection was always important to him.
Okay, so here's where we see that maybe audacious ambition really start to show. After college, he tries a few things: teaching, insurance, law, nothing really sticks.
Right.
Then, at just 18 years old, he makes this huge gamble. He raises $300,
yeah,
which back then was a lot of money, like over $10,000 today.
A substantial sum, yeah.
To purchase the Marion Star, this struggling daily newspaper. It was the weakest of the three papers in Marion at the time.
A real underdog paper.
Definitely. And he even used a perk of being a newspaper owner, a railroad pass, to go to the 1884 Republican National Convention, supported James G. Blaine.
So this wasn't just a business venture, was it? It feels like his first step into that bigger political world.
Absolutely. But it wasn't an easy start by any means. He gets back from Chicago, finds out the sheriff had reclaimed the paper because he couldn't make the payments.
Ouch.
Yeah. He even had to briefly work for a Democratic paper, which apparently he hated, before he managed to get full ownership back with some financial help from his father.
That early tenacity, though, it's striking. Sticking with it despite those setbacks shows a kind of stubborn resolve.
It really does.
Right.
And it paid off as Marion started booming. The population jumped from about 4,000 in 1880 to 12,000 by 1900. And as Marion grew, the Star's success grew right alongside it.
And he was smart about how he grew it. His editorial strategy was, well, pretty clever. He kept the Daily Star kind of tempered, nonpartisan, but then circulated a separate weekly edition that was moderately Republican.
Ah, best of both worlds.
Exactly. It attracted advertisers from all sides and eventually eliminated the local competition. He basically turned it into a local powerhouse. One biographer, Andrew Sinclair, called it a real Horatio Alger story.
Started with nothing.
Right. Through, as Sinclair put it, working, stalling, bluffing, withholding payments, borrowing back wages, boasting and manipulating, he turned this dying rag into a powerful small-town newspaper.
Sounds like a mix of hard work and maybe some sharp elbows.
Definitely. Sinclair credits his good looks, affability, enthusiasm, and persistence, plus a bit of good fortune. But he wasn't just the owner. He was an activist in the community. Invested in local businesses, and used his editorial page, as John Dean noted, to keep his nose in a prodding voice in all the town's public business.
And that deep understanding of public sentiment, honed right there at the Star, you can see how that would be a huge asset later in politics. He knew how to talk to people, gauge their interests, present ideas in a way they'd respond to, even if, you know, critics later found his speeches a bit vague.
Right, the bloviating, we'll get to that. And he was successful financially, too.
Oh, yeah. By 1923, when he died, his estate was worth about $850,000. That's nearly $15.7 million in today's money. So the business side definitely worked out.
Okay. You really can't talk about Warren Harding without talking about Florence Kling Harding, often called the Duchess.
The Duchess, sir.
She was 5 years older than him, daughter of this local banker, Amos Kling, who Harding apparently attacked frequently in his newspaper.
Awkward.
Very. And Florence, she had a bit of a past herself. She'd eloped, came back to Marion with an infant son, Marshall, who her father ended up raising, and she was making a living as a piano teacher. So their match was definitely unlikely.
And her father, Amos Kling, was fiercely against it. Spread rumors that the Hardings had African-American ancestry, a really toxic thing to do back then, and even encouraged boycotts of Harding's businesses.
Wow. How did Harding react to that?
Well, reportedly, Harding warned Kling he would, quote, beat the tar out of the little man if he didn't cease. Strong words.
Yikes.
Ah.
Quite the family drama.
It's an incredibly dramatic backdrop for a future president and first lady, isn't it? And it's worth noting, just on those ancestry rumors, genetic testing much later in 2015, determined with about 95% accuracy that Harding didn't have sub-Saharan African ancestors within four generations. So those rumors were effectively debunked, but they show the kind of racial animosity that was just, well, present.
So despite all that opposition, they got married.
They did. July 8, 1891, they had no children together. Harding affectionately called her the Duchess, apparently after a character in a newspaper serial who kept a close watch on the Duke and their money.
And she lived up to the name.
Oh, absolutely. Florence became deeply involved in his career, both at the Star and later in politics. She's widely credited with really turning the Star into a profitable business through her super strict management of the circulation department.
So she had a real head for business.
Absolutely. Some people even suggest she basically pushed him all the way to the White House. Florence herself apparently said, "He does well when he listens to me and poorly when he does not."
Huh. Sounds like she knew her mind.
She certainly did. And her influence was critical, especially when Harding had health issues. He had these periods of described as fatigue, overstrain, nervous illnesses, even an early heart ailment.
This was early on.
Yeah. Between 1889 and 1901, he had repeated stays at the Battle Creek Sanatorium for these issues. And while he was away, Florence stepped right in. She took over the business management of the Star.
Wow.
She held that role until 1915, which was absolutely crucial because it freed him up for his growing political travel and activities. She wasn't just a supportive spouse. She was a genuine business partner, a political partner, a real force.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? How many politicians, especially back then, had such an active, hands-on partner who was that instrumental in their rise? Her strategic mind, her resolve seems foundational.
So, with Florence really managing things back home and at the paper, Harding turned his ambition more seriously towards politics.
Right. After buying the Star, he didn't waste much time. Quickly aligned himself with the Republican Party, supported Governor Joseph B. Foraker's successful run in 1885. He was a real party loyalist, it seems.
Definitely. That loyalty would define a lot of his early career. By 1888, he's just 22, and he's already a delegate to the Republican State Convention, a role he held pretty often until he became president.
His first actual election attempt didn't go so well, though.
No, he lost a bid for Marion County Auditor in 1895, but apparently he did better than expected, which maybe gave him some encouragement. Then, in 1896, he campaigned hard across Ohio for William McKinley, the Republican presidential candidate. That's when he really started making a name for himself within those Ohio party circles.
And what stands out is how consistently he kept pursuing that political path, even with those early bumps.
Yeah, and his ability to, you know, maintain good relationships across different party factions was a huge asset. He managed to stay on good terms with both the dominant Republican factions in Ohio, the ones led by Senator Foraker and Senator Mark Hanna.
That takes skill.
It really does. Speaks to his, well, his affable nature, his pragmatic approach. It served him very well.
And that affability definitely helped him get elected to the Ohio State Senate in 1899. Started out as a relative unknown, but after 4 years,
he ended up as one of the most popular figures in the Ohio Republican Party, known for being calm, humble, the guy you could consult on tricky problems. He was so well-liked, he got renominated in 1901 and more than doubled his victory margin.
This was also when he became a Freemason.
Yes. Initiated into Marion Lodge No. 7 in 1901, just another way he deepened those community and network ties.
Now, his rise in Ohio politics, it all shows something about the era, right? Patronage and favors.
Oh, absolutely. You have to see it in context. Like many politicians back then, Harding accepted these things as just part of the political landscape. It wasn't necessarily seen as overtly corrupt in the way we might view it today.
Like the example of his sister.
Right. He arranged for his legally blind sister, Mary, to be appointed as a teacher at the Ohio School for the Blind, even though there were apparently better qualified candidates. His biographer, Sinclair, suggested Harding probably never thought there was anything really dishonest about that. It was just seen as a normal reward for party service.
Important context to keep in mind. And speaking of connections, a really crucial meeting happened around this time, early 1903.
Yes. He meets Harry M. Daugherty, the man who would become his attorney general, a key political fixer, his campaign manager.
And Daugherty had that famous quote after meeting him.
He did. Gee, what a great-looking president he'd make. Pretty amazing looking back, whether it was genuine foresight or just sizing up Harding's, you know, appearance and manner. It certainly proved prescient.
The pivotal connection, for sure. So Harding's next step was lieutenant governor.
That's right. From 1904 to 1906, he'd initially planned to run for governor in 03, but got persuaded to go for lieutenant governor instead, running on this 4-H ticket with Governor Myron T. Herrick. They won easily.
And it was a good spot for him.
Seems like it. While Governor Herrick made some unpopular decisions, Harding, as lieutenant governor, had little to do, and he did it very well. He used his role presiding over the state Senate to just keep expanding his political network quietly without attracting negative attention.
Smart. Just building those connections. Mm-hmm. Did he try for governor again?
He wanted to in 1905, but the party leaders blocked him, so maybe a missed opportunity there. But he kept navigating these tricky Republican factions. In 1908, for the presidential primary, he initially backed his old patron, Foraker, against Teddy Roosevelt's chosen successor, William Howard Taft. but he quickly felt the heat, as the sources say, the political pressure. And he reversed course in the Star, endorsing Taft instead, a pragmatic move that probably saved his political career because Foraker ended up losing badly.
Shows those political survival instincts again. Loyalty is important, but knowing when to shift is key for advancement.
Exactly. But even with his popularity, he still faced defeat. He won the Republican nomination for governor in 1910, with Daugherty managing the campaign.
But the party was split.
Badly split, between the progressive wing and the conservative wing. Even though both President Taft and former President Roosevelt campaigned for him, their own feud was tearing the party apart. So Harding lost to the incumbent Democrat, Judson Harmon.
Man, those party splits were brutal. So what happened in 1912 when Taft and Roosevelt went head-to-head?
Harding stayed loyal to the party, the regular Republican ticket. Taft asked him to give the speech nominating him at the convention, which was incredibly divided and bitter.
He actually did it. Nominated Taft against Roosevelt.
He did. Even as Roosevelt supporters were bolting to form the Progressive Party, the Bull Moose Party, which guaranteed Woodrow Wilson's victory, Harding stuck with the Republican ticket. He was a party man, through and through, even when it meant going down with the ship, prioritizing that party unity, which, you know, would make him look good later as a potential unifier.
Okay, let's jump ahead to 1914. The whole game has changed in Ohio politics by then.
Right. They've got the 17th Amendment ratified, so senators are now directly elected by the people, not chosen by the legislature. And Ohio had also started using primary elections.
So Harding decides to run for the U.S. Senate.
Well, he was urged to run after the sitting congressman, Theodore Burton, dropped out. And Harry Daugherty, naturally, claimed he was the one who pushed Harding into the race.
Of course he did. And Harding's campaign strategy.
It was described as sweetness and light. The idea was to offend nobody except Democrats. Play to his strengths at affable, agreeable personality. And it worked in the primary. He beat his old patron, Foraker, by a pretty comfortable margin.
Now, the general election, that had a bit of an unpleasant side to it.
It did. And it's revealing about the times. His opponent was the Ohio Attorney General, Timothy Hogan, who was Roman Catholic. And he faced just widespread nativist prejudice, especially in rural parts of the state.
Propaganda linking him to the Pope and stuff.
Exactly. These propaganda sheets were claiming Hogan was part of some plot by Pope Benedict XV to control Ohio. Just ugly stuff. Now, Harding himself didn't personally attack Hogan. They were actually old friends.
But he didn't condemn the prejudice either.
No. He did not denounce the nativist hatred for his opponent. He stayed silent on it. Politically smart, maybe, in that climate, but it's an interesting reflection on his character and how deeply ingrained those prejudices were.
Yeah, that's uncomfortable to look back on. But his overall style worked.
It seemed to. His conciliatory approach, combined with what sources describe as his rambling, high-sounding mixture of platitudes, patriotism, and pure nonsense stump speeches.
Huh. Pure nonsense.
Well, that's one description. But whatever it was, it resonated. He won by over 100,000 votes. It was part of a big Republican sweep in Ohio that year. So off to Washington he went.
And in the Senate. He wasn't exactly a firebrand, was he?
No, not at all. He was a junior senator. Republicans were in the minority. Congress was controlled by the Democrats under President Wilson. So Harding got relatively unimportant committee assignments. But apparently he did his duties assiduously, diligently.
Just kept his head down and did the work.
Oh, pretty much. He was known as a safe, conservative Republican vote.
Yeah.
And just like in the Ohio Senate, he quickly became really well-liked by his colleagues on both sides of the aisle. That congenial nature was a real asset in the Senate.
And he started taking positions on some big national issues, like women's suffrage and prohibition.
Yeah, and his positions were often quite nuanced, pragmatic maybe. On women's suffrage, initially he said he couldn't support it until Ohio did. Standard political hedging.
But he came around.
He did. As support grew nationally and in Ohio, he became a firm supporter by the time Congress actually voted on the amendment. Shows he was responsive to public opinion shifts.
And prohibition. That must have been tricky for someone who apparently enjoyed a drink.
Very tricky. He personally drank, yes, initially voted against banning alcohol. But then when the 18th Amendment came up, he voted for it, but only after getting a time limit added for ratification, hoping that would kill it.
Clever. Maybe too clever.
Well, it didn't work. The amendment got ratified anyway. So then he voted to override President Wilson's veto of the Volstead Act, the law that actually implemented prohibition. Why? Probably to secure the support of the very powerful Anti-Saloon League.
Wow. That's some serious political maneuvering. Keep everyone happy, or at least not too angry.
Exactly. It really shows his political pragmatism. Adapt your stance, read the room, don't alienate key groups. Crucial skills if you're thinking about higher office.
And his profile kept rising within the party. He got a prime spot at the 1916 Republican National Convention.
He did. Asked to be temporary chairman and deliver the keynote address, he used it to preach party unity, urging delegates to stand together. That would become his big theme later. The convention ended up nominating Charles Evans Hughes.
Then came World War I. Where did Harding stand?
He spoke and voted for Wilson's resolution declaring war in April 1917. Initially, he was pretty gung-ho about supporting the president in wartime, even argued for giving Wilson almost dictatorial powers, saying democracy had little place in time of war.
Strong words. Did he support all the war measures?
Mostly. He voted for things like the Espionage Act, which really restricted civil liberties, but he did oppose the excess profits tax on businesses, seeing it as anti-business. By May 1918, though, his enthusiasm for Wilson had cooled, and he started opposing further expansion of presidential powers.
Okay, so his views evolved. Now, the League of Nations debate after the war, this feels like a really defining moment for him.
Absolutely pivotal. Republicans narrowly won back control of the Senate in the 1918 midterms, and Harding landed a spot on the really important Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Just as Wilson was coming back from Paris with the Treaty of Versailles.
Exactly. And Wilson made this huge political blunder. He didn't take any senators, Republican or Democrat, with him to the Paris Peace Conference. He was supremely confident he could just force the treaty and the League of Nations through the Senate.
Big mistake.
Huge. Many senators, including Harding, intensely disliked Article X of the League Covenant. That was the part committing members to defend any other member nation if attacked. They saw it as dragging the U.S. into future wars without Congress having a say.
The sovereignty issue.
Precisely. Harding was one of 39 senators who signed this round-robin letter, basically saying they opposed the League as Wilson presented it.
Did he confront Wilson directly?
He did. There was a White House meeting with the Foreign Relations Committee, and sources say Harding ably questioned Wilson about Article X, but Wilson apparently just evaded his inquiries. This really highlights Harding's ability to articulate those concerns about congressional power and national sovereignty.
So Harding became a leading voice against the League.
He made a major speech against the treaty in September 1919, and with Wilson then suffering a debilitating stroke and public support for the League starting to fade, the treaty was ultimately defeated in the Senate twice. This whole fight firmly cemented Harding's position against Wilsonian internationalism, making him a very appealing alternative for a country tired of war and foreign entanglements. #HORDA for the normalcy election of 1920.
Okay, 1920. The Republican nomination is suddenly wide open.
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt was the expected frontrunner, but he died suddenly in January 1919. That just blew the field wide open. You had several big names jump in: General Leonard Wood, Illinois Governor Frank Loudon, California Senator Hiram Johnson.
All pretty prominent figures.
Definitely. And then some lesser known ones testing the waters too, like Herbert Hoover, Calvin Coolidge, and of course Warren G. Harding.
Now, Harding wanted the presidency, but he also had other motivations.
Right. He was apparently just as motivated by wanting to keep control of Republican politics back in Ohio, making sure he could get reelected to the Senate. He made a pretty low-key announcement of his presidential candidacy in December 1919. Sources suggest he didn't actually think he had much of a shot.
But the party establishment liked him more than the frontrunners.
That seems to be the case. The party's old guard leaders, the more conservative wing, they weren't thrilled with the progressive leanings of Wood and Johnson or Loudon's independent streak. Harding was seen as more, well, manageable, more reliable.
Enter Harry Daugherty again.
Enter Harry Daugherty, the master strategist, or at least that's how he presented himself. Daugherty predicted the frontrunners would deadlock at the convention. His strategy was to position Harding as the perfect long shot, the compromise candidate everyone could eventually agree on when the favorites flamed out.
So Daugherty set up shop in Washington.
Yep. Set up a campaign office, managed this network of supporters, all geared towards a brokered convention scenario where Harding could emerge.
But Harding's actual performance in the primaries wasn't great.
No, it was pretty weak, honestly. He barely won his home state, Ohio, beating Wood by only about 15,000 votes, getting less than half the total vote there. And in Indiana, he finished fourth, won zero delegates.
That must have been discouraging.
Deeply discouraging. Sources say Harding was ready to throw in the towel, quit the race, and just refile to run for his Senate seat again.
But then Florence stepped in. The Duchess.
The Duchess to the rescue. The story goes, She literally grabbed the phone out of his hand while he was trying to quit, declared, "Warren Harding, what are you doing? Give up. Not until the convention is over. Think of your friends in Ohio."
Wow.
And later, she apparently told someone, "Will you tell Harry Daugherty for me that we're in this fight until hell freezes over?"
Uh-huh. You do not mess with the Duchess.
Absolutely not. Her fierce determination, her belief in him, it was critical in keeping him in the race at that low point.
So after that reality check, and maybe Florence's pep talk, Harding gives this really important speech.
Yes, in Boston. And this is where he introduces the word that becomes his trademark, normalcy.
What was the line exactly? That's pretty famous.
It is. He said, "America's present need is not heroics, but healing. Not nostrums, but normalcy. Not revolution, but restoration. Not agitation, but adjustment. Not surgery, but serenity. Not the dramatic, but the dispassionate. Not experiment, but equipoise. Not submergence in internationality, but sustainment in triumphant nationality."
Wow. That's quite a list. And normalcy, he didn't invent the word, right? But he made it famous.
Exactly. He popularized it. And it just resonated so deeply with the country. People were exhausted after World War I, the Spanish flu pandemic, the post-war recession, the political turmoil. They were tired of Wilson's lofty idealism and global crusades.
They just wanted things to get back to.
It's normal.
Precisely. As biographer Dean put it, Harding was reading the nation's pulse correctly. That call for a return to a simpler pre-war way of life, less government intervention, less foreign entanglement, it struck a powerful chord.
Okay, so on to the convention in Chicago, June 1920. It's deeply divided, intensely divided. And adding fuel to the fire was a recent Senate investigation into campaign spending. It found the frontrunners had spent huge sums, Wood, nearly $1.8 million, Loudon, $600,000.
And Harding.
Harding, only about $113,000. So he looked clean by comparison.
And the convention itself was chaotic. No single boss in charge.
Right. Nearly 1,000 delegates, including 27 women, which was new since the 19th Amendment was about to be ratified. No Republican in the White House meant no patronage power to control delegates. No single party boss could dictate the outcome. It was wide open.
Harding was still seen as a long shot, a dark horse.
Initially, yeah. Reporters weren't giving him much chance. But then the former Ohio governor, Willis, gave this very folksy, brief nominating speech for Harding, and it apparently created a real warm feeling for him among the delegates.
The deadlock happens.
Right.
4 ballots, nobody can win. Wood and Loudon are stuck.
Exactly. And that leads to the night of June 11th into the 12th, the night that becomes legendary as the night of the smoke-filled room at the Blackstone Hotel.
Ugh, the famous smoke-filled room. So the legend is that party bosses met secretly, and basically forced Harding's nomination.
That's the legend, yes. A cabal of senators and party elders deciding the nominee in secret. But historians who've looked closely say there wasn't really a formal pact to nominate Harding that night.
So what did happen in the room?
Well, key figures were definitely talking. Influential senators like Reed Smoot were arguing that Harding was the best bet to win Ohio in the general election against the likely Democratic nominee James Cox, who was also from Ohio. Others just looked at the mess, the deadlock, the liabilities of the frontrunners, and concluded Harding was the logical compromise, the path of least resistance.
So less of a conspiracy, more of a consensus emerging out of exhaustion and pragmatism.
Probably closer to that. But the rumors of a cabal of senators making a deal spread among the delegates. And that perception actually helped Harding because delegates started seeing him as the inevitable way out of the gridlock.
The backroom maneuvering, even if not a single deal, certainly played a role. So the next day, balloting resumes.
And Harding starts steadily gaining votes, ballot after ballot. Eventually, the convention chairman, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, calls for a recess, which makes Daugherty furious. He thinks they're trying to stop Harding's momentum.
But it doesn't work.
Nope. On the ninth ballot, Harding takes the lead. Governor Loudon then releases his delegates. And on the 10th ballot, it's over. Harding's nomination becomes unanimous.
Wow. From dark horse to nominee in 10 ballots, and then the vice president.
That was almost an afterthought. Delegates were exhausted, wanted to get out of Chicago. They quickly nominated Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge. He was popular for breaking the Boston police strike the year before. He actually got even more votes than Harding did on his first ballot.
So the ticket is Harding and Coolidge. How did the press react? Mixed, you said.
Very mixed. Republican papers fell in line, naturally, but others were just scathing. The New York World called Harding the least qualified candidate since James Buchanan, a weak and mediocre man with no original idea.
Ouch, Buchanan. That's harsh.
It is. The Hearst papers called him the flag bearer of a new senatorial autocracy. The New York Times was a bit milder, just calling him a very respectable Ohio politician of the second class. Not exactly a ringing endorsement for the man who just won the nomination.
Quite the welcome. So the general election campaign, the Democrats nominate James Cox, governor of Ohio.
Right. And for VP, a young assistant secretary of the Navy named Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Interesting matchup. Two Ohio newspaper editors running against each other, Cox the liberal, Harding the conservative.
Provides a very clear choice for the voters.
And Harding runs what kind of campaign?
He decides on a traditional front porch campaign, stays home in Marion, Ohio, delivers speeches to delegations that come visit him, very much like McKinley did in 1896. Harding even had his porch remodeled to look like McKinley's.
While Cox and FDR are out barnstorming the country.
Exactly. They're crisscrossing the nation, making hundreds of speeches. Harding, meanwhile, is at home. And being a newspaper man himself, he had this easy relationship with the press covering him. They liked him. That camaraderie was a real asset.
And the return to normalcy theme, combined with the image of quiet Marion, Ohio, that resonated.
Deeply. Voters were looking for stability, order, after the chaos of the war years. Marion seemed to represent that.
But his speeches themselves, they weren't exactly thrilling.
No. Critics found his oratory really vague, full of platitudes. William G. McAdoo famously described a Harding speech as an army of pompous phrases moving over the landscape in search of an idea.
Uh-huh. That's quite an image.
And H.L. Mencken, the sharp-tongued journalist, just called it rumble and bumble. It is balder and dash.
Balderdash. Love it.
But interestingly, the New York Times had a different take. They thought his speeches actually reflected the indeterminate thoughts of the average voter. That maybe his very vagueness was part of his appeal. People were tired of grand visions.
What about the League of Nations? Wilson called the election a great and solemn referendum on it.
Right. Harding had to walk a fine line. He stuck to his opposition to Wilson's League, but he talked about favoring some kind of association of nations, maybe based on the World Court at The Hague. It was vague enough to keep most Republicans happy, both the isolationists and the mild internationalists.
And Cox eventually shifted his position, too.
Yeah. By October, even Cox admitted that reservations to the League treaty might be necessary. That basically took the issue off the table, allowed Harding to just stop talking about it. It neutralized Wilson's big referendum.
And the Republicans ran a modern campaign, advertising and all that.
Very modern for the time. The RNC hired this top advertising executive, Albert Lasker. He launched this huge campaign using all the new media, newsreels, sound recordings, billboards, magazines. They even used telemarketers reading scripted dialogue.
Telemarketers in 1920. Wow.
Yeah. And when delegations visited Marion, they'd get their photos taken with Warren and Florence, and the campaign would send those photos to their hometown newspapers. Really sophisticated, personalized marketing for the era.
Meanwhile, the old, ugly rumors about his ancestry resurfaced.
They did. Opponents brought up the old claims about him having black ancestry. His campaign manager just denied them, rejected them.
So Election Day, November 2, 1920. His birthday, actually.
Right, and it was a landslide. A massive victory for Harding. He got 60.2% of the popular vote. That's still the highest percentage for a Republican presidential candidate since the modern two-party system really emerged. 404 electoral votes.
And Cox?
Cox got just 34% of the vote, 127 electoral votes. Even Eugene V. Debs, the socialist leader running from a federal prison cell.
Right, he was jailed for opposing the war.
He still got 3% of the vote, nearly a million votes. But the big story was the Republican sweep. They massively increased their majorities in both the House and Senate. It was a clear, undeniable mandate for Harding and his promise of normalcy. That huge victory gave Harding a really strong mandate coming into office. He was inaugurated March 4th, 1921, and he chose a pretty subdued ceremony, skipped the usual big parade.
Setting a different tone right away.
Yeah.
What about his inaugural address?
He laid out his philosophy pretty clearly. Declared, "Our most dangerous tendency is to expect too much from the government and at the same time do too little for it. A real call for limited government, individual responsibility. A definite shift from the progressive era under Wilson and Roosevelt."
And his cabinet. He famously said he wanted the best minds in the country. Did he get them?
Well, he certainly got some truly outstanding people. Charles Evans Hughes at Secretary of State Harding gave him a lot of leeway on foreign policy. Andrew W. Mellon, one of the richest men in America as Treasury Secretary. And Herbert Hoover as Secretary of Commerce. These were top-tier, highly respected figures.
Definitely best minds material. But it wasn't all A-listers, was it?
No, it was a real mix. And that mix, that blend of brilliance and, well, questionable loyalty would really define his presidency, for better and for worse. You had political loyalists like Will Hayes, the RNC chairman, becoming Postmaster General. He later left to become Hollywood's first censor, interestingly.
He's code guy.
The very same. But then you had the really controversial, problematic appointments. Albert B. Fall as Interior Secretary. He was a Western rancher, former miner, big proponent of developing natural resources. Conservationists like Gifford Pinchot were immediately alarmed.
And the big one, Harry Daugherty as Attorney General.
Right. His longtime friend, political fixer from Ohio, the New York Times just mocked that appointment, saying Harding chose merely a best friend over the best minds.
But Harding trusted him.
Completely. Saw him as, according to historians Trunnion and Wilson, a competent lawyer well acquainted with the seamy side of politics, a first-class political troubleshooter, someone he could rely on implicitly. This tension, though, between the high-minded idealists like Hughes and Hoover and the cronies like Daugherty and Fall, it laid the groundwork for both success and disaster.
A fascinating, almost dangerous dynamic. So Harding takes office, and the economy is not in great shape. Post-war recession, high unemployment.
Yeah, unemployment hit 12% in 1921. The country was in a slump after the war boom ended.
But here's something often overlooked. The economic policies under Harding really seemed to set the stage for the roaring 20s boom that followed. How did that happen? How did they turn things around so dramatically?
It was a major shift, largely driven by Treasury Secretary Mellon's ideas about taxes and a big push for deregulation. In his first big speech to Congress in April 1921, Harding called for cutting wartime income taxes, raising tariffs to protect farm goods, and supporting new industries like highways, aviation, radio.
Getting government spending under control was also key.
Absolutely. He signed the Budget and Accounting Act in June 1921, creating the Bureau of the Budget, the first formal federal budget process. And he appointed Charles Dawes, a tough Chicago banker, as its first director with a clear order: cut spending.
And Mellon's tax plan, that was the big one.
That was the centerpiece. Mellon was a firm believer in what we'd now call supply-side economics. He argued that the high wartime tax rates, the top rate was 73%, were actually counterproductive, driving money underground or into tax shelters instead of productive investment.
So, cut the rates to stimulate the economy.
Exactly. Mellon proposed slashing income tax rates across the board and getting rid of the corporate excess profits tax. Harding's big revenue bill, based on Mellon's plan, cut that top marginal rate dramatically from 73% in 1921 down to 25% by 1925. And they cut taxes for lower incomes too.
Did it face resistance? Tax cuts usually do.
Oh yeah, big fights in Congress, especially in the Senate. It got tangled up with efforts to give World War I veterans a cash bonus. Harding actively fought against the bonus, arguing it would break down our treasury. He even vetoed a bonus bill in 1922, and his veto was barely sustained.
So the tax cuts passed. What was the impact?
Pretty dramatic, actually. Combined with the deregulation push, federal spending as a share of the economy fell significantly. And by late 1922, the economy really started to roar back. Unemployment plummeted from that 12% in 1921 to an average of just 3.3% for the rest of the decade.
Wow, 3.3% average. That's incredible.
It really is. The misery index, which combines unemployment and inflation, saw its sharpest drop in American history under Harding. Wages went up, profits went up, productivity soared. GDP grew by an average of over 5% a year through the 1920s.
So some historians argue Mellon's policies really fueled the boom.
Yes, particularly more libertarian-leaning historians like Schweikart and Allen. They contend that Mellon's tax policies set the stage for the most amazing growth yet seen in America's already impressive economy. It's a significant economic legacy, often completely overshadowed by the scandals that came later.
It really is a different picture than the usual narrative. And Harding wasn't just focused on taxes, he embraced new technologies too.
He absolutely did. He saw the future. The 1920s, that was the dawn of the motor car age. Mass production of cars was transforming everything, stimulating highway construction, rubber, steel, even hotels for tourists.
And he supported federal investment in roads.
Big time. He signed the Federal Highway Act of 1921. It invested a significant amount, $162 million back then, about $3 billion today, into building up America's highway system between 21 and 23. He said in 1922 that the motor car reflects our standard of living and gauges the speed of our present-day life. he got it.
What about radio and aviation? Still very new then.
He urged regulation for radio broadcasting as early as April 1921. His Commerce Secretary Hoover really took the lead there, convening conferences that led to voluntary agreements on assigning radio frequencies the beginnings of order in the airwaves. Hoover also pushed for developing commercial aviation, focusing on safety rules and pilot licensing. Full regulation came later, but they laid the groundwork.
So a very pro-business administration overall.
Definitely. Harding believed government's role was to help business thrive. He viewed organized labor with, well, suspicion.
How did he handle labor issues? There were major strikes in 1922.
Yeah, 1922 was a tough year for labor relations. Falling wages, high unemployment led to widespread unrest. You had a huge coal miners' strike. 500,000 miners led by John L. Lewis walked out over wage cuts.
How did Harding respond?
He offered a compromise, got the miners to go back to work while a commission investigated their grievances. Then 400,000 railroad workers went on strike. Harding proposed a settlement, but the railroad managers rejected it.
So then what?
Attorney General Daugherty stepped in and got a really sweeping federal court injunction to break the strike. Harding actually thought the injunction went too far and had it amended slightly. But it worked. The injunction ended the strike, though it left a lot of bad blood. Shows the administration wasn't afraid to use federal power against labor.
But there was one significant win for labor, the steel industry.
Yes, that's a really notable achievement, often overlooked. While the 8-hour workday was becoming more common, the steel mills still had these brutal 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. Hoover and Harding thought this was just barbaric and put pressure on the steel manufacturers to change.
Did they listen?
Not at first. The head of U.S. Steel, Elbert Gerry, led a committee that resisted. But then Harding wrote a letter to Gerry urging the change, and it got leaked to the press. The public outcry was huge. That pressure finally forced the manufacturers to give in and standardize the 8-hour day in the steel industry. A major victory.
Okay, let's shift to civil rights and immigration. Always complex areas. Harding seemed to make some positive signals on civil rights early on.
He did. His very first address to Congress called for federal anti-lynching legislation. That was a significant statement. And then in October 1921, he gave this remarkable speech in Birmingham, Alabama.
Birmingham, in the Deep South.
Yes, to a segregated audience, 20,000 whites, 10,000 blacks. And while he said social and racial differences probably couldn't be bridged reflecting the common view, then he boldly called for equal political rights for African Americans.
What did he say exactly?
He said, "Whether you like it or not, unless our democracy is a lie, you must stand for that equality." The black section of the audience reportedly cheered wildly. The white section listened in silence. That took real courage in that place at that time.
Absolutely. And he spoke out after the Tulsa Massacre.
He did. Just 3 days after that horrific event in 1921, Harding spoke at Lincoln University, an all-black college in Pennsylvania, and condemned it. God grant that. We never see another spectacle like it. So he used the bully pulpit on race sometimes.
He supported the Dyer anti-lynching bill, too.
Yes, he supported Congressman Leonidas Dyer's bill, which would have made lynching a federal crime. It actually passed the House in January 1922.
But it failed in the Senate.
It did. Southern Democrats filibustered it. And the Republican leader, Senator Lodge, eventually withdrew the bill so they could debate Harding's favored ship subsidy bill instead, which also failed, ironically.
So black leaders blamed Harding.
Many did. They felt he prioritized the subsidy bill over fighting for the anti-lynching law, that his desire for the subsidy hastened the Dyer bill's demise. Shows the limits of presidential power against entrenched opposition and how political priorities can have unintended consequences.
A complex picture. What about immigration? This was the era of the Red Scare. Lots of anti-immigrant feeling.
Very much so. Public suspicion, especially towards socialists, communists, Eastern and Southern Europeans, was high. Harding signed the Percentum Act of 1921.
The first big quota act.
Right. It drastically restricted immigration, limiting it to 3% of the number of people from a given country who were already living in the U.S. based on the 1910 census. This hit Italians and Eastern European Jews much harder than, say, Irish or Germans who had larger populations here in 1910.
But there was some leniency in how it was applied.
Apparently so. Sources say Harding and his labor secretary, James Davis, tried to ensure it was enforced humanely. They allowed nearly 1,000 immigrants who were technically deportable under the new law to remain. So again, you see this tension between bowing to public pressure for restriction and a desire for maybe some compassion in individual cases.
Another act of normalcy people point to is his release of political prisoners.
Yes, that was significant. Eugene Debs, his socialist opponent in 1920, was was still in prison for opposing World War I. Wilson had refused to pardon him. Daugherty, Harding's attorney general, actually met Debs and was apparently impressed by him.
But there was opposition to releasing him.
Oh, yeah. From veterans groups, even from Florence Harding. But Harding went ahead. He commuted Debs' sentence on December 23, 1921. Debs even came to the White House to thank Harding before going home.
That must have been quite a scene.
Imagine. Harding released 23 other war opponents at the same time and kept reviewing cases. He defended it as necessary to get the nation back to normalcy, to heal the divisions from the war. A pretty bold move, politically.
And finally, his judicial appointments. He got to shape the Supreme Court.
He did. Made 4 appointments in just over 2 years. Most famously, he fulfilled a promise to appoint former President William Howard Taft as Chief Justice.
Taft finally got his dream job.
He did. The other 3 were solid economic conservatives, George Sutherland, Pierce Butler, Edward Terry Sanford. These appointments definitely shifted the court in a more conservative direction for years to come. Plus, he appointed dozens of judges to lower federal courts. So his impact on the judiciary was quite significant.
Okay, let's turn to foreign policy. Harding made it clear from the start that his Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, would be largely in charge.
Yes, a big departure from Wilson, who really ran his own foreign policy. Harding trusted Hughes and gave him significant autonomy. And Harding's main stance was clear: no League of Nations. He hardened his position after the election, deciding the U.S. wouldn't join even a modified version.
So, first step was officially ending the war. The U.S. was technically still at war since the Versailles Treaty wasn't ratified.
Exactly. They passed the Knox-Porter Resolution in July 1921. It formally declared peace and reserved any rights the U.S. might have had under the Versailles Treaty. Then they negotiated separate peace treaties with Germany, Austria, and Hungary, which were ratified later that year. Finally, the war was officially over for America.
Did the U.S. completely ignore the League after that?
Not entirely. At first, the State Department kind of ignored League communications or bypassed them. But by 1922, they started engaging cautiously. The U.S. consul in Geneva began attending League meetings as an observer, but only for technical and humanitarian matters, not political ones.
So limited engagement, not full isolation. What about the huge war debts owed to the U.S. and German reparations?
That was a massive issue. European governments wanted the U.S. to reduce the debts they owed from the war. Germany wanted its reparation payments reduced, but the U.S. refused to deal with it multilaterally. They insisted on negotiating with each country separately.
Mellon handled the debts.
Harding wanted to give Mellon broad authority to negotiate debt reductions, but Congress passed a more restrictive bill in 1922. Still, Hughes managed to negotiate a key agreement with Britain. They agreed to pay off their war debt over 62 years at a low interest rate. That became the model for deals with other countries. And the German reparations issue eventually led to the Dawes Plan in 1924 after Harding's death.
What about relations with the new Bolshevik government and Russia? Wilson had refused to recognize them.
Right. And the U.S. had even sent troops to Russia during their civil war. Under Harding, policy was largely driven by Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover, who actually had a lot of experience dealing with Russia.
Hoover advocated engagement.
He did, especially on the humanitarian front. When a terrible famine hit Russia in 1921, Hoover's American Relief Administration provided massive amounts of food aid. The Soviets hoped this might lead to U.S. recognition, but it didn't.
So no recognition, but maybe trade.
Hoover supported allowing trade with the Soviets, arguing U.S. companies would lose out if they didn't engage. But Secretary Hughes was opposed to recognition and wary of trade. So the issue remained unresolved during Harding's presidency, a clear division within the cabinet.
Okay, one of Harding's biggest foreign policy successes, maybe the biggest, was the Washington Naval Conference.
Absolutely. A major achievement. Disarmament and cutting defense spending was a campaign promise. An influential senator, William Borah of Idaho, proposed a conference of the major naval powers, the U.S., Britain, Japan, to agree on cuts to their fleets. Harding jumped on the idea.
So they invited other nations, too.
Yes. Representatives from 9 nations eventually gathered in Washington in November 1921. The timing was significant. Too many delegates attended the Armistice Day ceremonies at Arlington National Cemetery, where Harding gave this very moving speech at the entombment of the unknown soldier. It set a solemn, hopeful tone for the talks.
And Secretary Hughes made a dramatic opening move.
Incredibly dramatic. At the very first session, Hughes stunned the delegates by proposing specific deep cuts. He said the U.S. would scrap 30 warships, battleships, and cruisers if Great Britain scrapped 19 and Japan scrapped 17. basically putting America's own fleet on the chopping block first to show they were serious.
Bold move. Did it work?
Largely, yes. The conference was a big success. They reached agreements setting limits on the tonnage of capital ships, battleships, and aircraft carriers for the major powers. Though, importantly, it didn't limit smaller ships like cruisers and submarines, which allowed for naval buildups later.
What else did they agree on?
They settled some disputes over islands in the Pacific and agreed to limits on using poison gas in warfare. Overall, Harding and Hughes got widespread praise, both at home and abroad, for this diplomatic achievement. And key senators like Lodge and Oscar Underwood helped ensure the treaties were ratified by the Senate. A real win for arms control.
Should you could achieve things outside the League framework. But not everything went smoothly. The shipping board had issues.
Yeah, that was less successful. The U.S. had built over 1,000 ships during WWI and now didn't know what to do with them. Harding appointed Albert Lasker the admin from his campaign as chairman of the shipping board. Lasker actually ran the fleet profitably for a while, hoping to sell the ships off.
But they couldn't sell them?
Not easily. Lasker recommended a big government subsidy for the American Merchant Marine to make buying and operating the ships more attractive. Harding pushed hard for the subsidy bill in Congress, but it was deeply unpopular and got filibustered to death in the Senate, so most of those government ships eventually just got scrapped. A big waste, really.
What about Latin America? Harding had criticized Wilson's interventions there during the campaign.
He had. He'd attacked Wilson's policies in the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and even went after Franklin Roosevelt for his role in Haiti. Secretary Hughes worked to improve relations with Latin American countries, who were very wary of how the U.S. used the Monroe Doctrine to justify intervention.
Did U.S. troops actually leave?
They were withdrawn from Cuba in 1921, but U.S. forces remained in Nicaragua, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic throughout Harding's presidency. So the rhetoric changed more than the reality on the ground in some places.
But he did try to mend fences with Colombia over Panama.
Yes, that was significant. He secured Senate ratification of the Thompson-Arusha Treaty in April 1921. It granted Colombia $25 million, a huge sum then, over $440 million today as compensation for the U.S.-backed Panamanian Revolution back in 1903 that stripped Panama from Colombia, a major gesture to repair past damage.
Did that satisfy Latin American concerns about interventionism?
Not entirely. The U.S. still refused to formally renounce interventionism, though Hughes did pledge to limit it to countries near the Panama Canal and be clearer about U.S. aims. But the underlying policy remained, which left lingering mistrust.
And relations with Mexico were also tricky. Wilson hadn't recognized the revolutionary government there.
Right. The Mexican president, Alvaro Obregón, wanted U.S. recognition before negotiating issues like compensation for American losses during the revolution. But Hughes and Interior Secretary Fall initially opposed recognition first. They sent Mexico a draft treaty demanding pledges to protect American property and settle claims.
Obregón refused.
He refused to sign anything before getting recognition. Instead, he cleverly worked behind the scenes, building ties with American businesses operating in Mexico, launching a PR campaign in the U.S. These efforts gradually softened the resistance in Washington.
So recognition didn't happen under Harding?
No, it remained unresolved when he died. But the groundwork was laid. The U.S. finally recognized the Obregón government on August 31, 1923, just under a month after Harding's death, and largely on Mexico's terms. #7, the voyage of understanding and sudden death.
Okay, so by 1922, Harding's presidency hit some turbulence. The midterm elections didn't go well for the Republicans.
No, they were a real setback. Even though Harding had delivered on things like tax cuts, a lot of his policies hadn't really resonated with voters yet. Unemployment was still pretty high at 11% that year. Organized labor was angry about the strike breaking. Republicans lost a lot of seats in both the House and Senate.
Did that change Harding's approach?
It seems to have. He realized his initial hands-off view of the presidency, proposed policies, let Congress figure it out, wasn't working. He started getting more personally involved, actively lobbying for legislation like that failed ship subsidy bill. Showed he was adapting, learning on the job, maybe?
And things started looking up in 1923. His popularity recovered.
It did, yeah. After Congress adjourned in March 23, the economy was clearly improving. The programs run by his star cabinet members, Hughes, Mellon, Hoover, were starting to show positive results. His popularity began to rebound. Most Republicans fully expected him to run for re-election in 1924 and were ready to support him. It looked like he was weathering the storm.
But behind the scenes, his health was failing, even if he didn't always show it.
Yes, definitely declining. And there are these little hints looking back. In the first half of 1923, he sold the Marion Star, the newspaper that made him. Said he'd stay on as a contributing editor, but still, selling it was significant. He also made a new will. Actions that some later saw as maybe a subconscious sense that time was short.
He had known heart issues.
Yes, he'd had health problems off and on for years. And when he wasn't having symptoms, he apparently tended to overeat, drink, smoke too much. Classic unhealthy lifestyle. He'd known about a heart condition since at least 1919. Add the immense stress of the presidency, plus his wife Florence was suffering from a chronic kidney condition, which worried him. It all took a toll.
He had the flu earlier in 1923, too.
Yeah, a bad bout of influenza in January 23. And sources say he never fully bounced back. Started struggling to even finish a round of golf. Another senator, Willis, saw him in June 23 and remarked that Harding just seems so tired.
Which makes his next decision seem almost reckless. This huge trip he planned for the summer of 23.
The Voyage of Understanding, he called it. Incredibly ambitious. Planned to travel all across the country by train, go north up to the Alaska Territory, then south along the West Coast, then take a Navy ship through the Panama Canal, and finally back to Washington by late August.
What was the purpose? A pre-campaign swing for 1924.
Partly that, yeah. A chance to get out, meet people, give speeches, or bloviate, as he himself apparently called his own oratory sometimes. Also, frankly, just to escape the brutal Washington, D.C. summer heat. But the schedule was incredibly demanding, especially for someone in his condition.
Where did he go on the first leg?
Spoke about transportation in Kansas City, farming in Hutchinson, Kansas, tackled prohibition in Denver, visited Yellowstone and Zion National Parks, dedicated a monument on the old Oregon Trail. He also, interestingly, started speaking out more strongly in favor of the U.S. joining the world court during this trip.
Then up to Alaska.
Yeah.
That was groundbreaking.
First sitting president ever to visit Alaska. Embarked on the USS Henderson from Washington State on July 5th. Sources say he spent hours just watching the amazing Alaskan scenery go by. He gave a speech to about 1,500 people in Fairbanks in 94-degree heat.
Wow. Then Canada. Also a first.
First sitting U.S. president to visit Canada. Toured Vancouver on July 26th, spoke to a huge crowd, over 50,000 people. They actually unveiled a memorial to him in Vancouver's Stanley Park a couple of years later, shows the goodwill he generated there.
But the trip was clearly taking a visible toll.
Oh, absolutely. In Vancouver, he tried to play golf, but only managed 6 holes before he was exhausted, had to rest for an hour.
Wow.
Then he played the last 2 holes just so it looked like he finished the round. A reporter who saw him there wrote that he looked so tired that a rest of mere days would be insufficient to refresh him.
His last speech was in Seattle.
Yes, July 27th at the University of Washington. Spoke to 25,000 people, predicted statehood for Alaska, but accounts say he rushed through the speech, didn't wait for applause, just seemed drained.
And that same night, things took a bad turn.
They did. He went to bed early. Later that night, he called for his personal physician, Dr. Charles Sawyer, complaining of bad pain in his upper abdomen. Sawyer thought it was just his recurring stomach problems. But another doctor on the trip, Joel Boone, suspected a heart issue.
What did they tell the press?
They downplayed it, said it was an acute gastrointestinal attack, canceled his planned weekend stop in Portland.
Did he seem to rally?
A bit. He felt better the next day on the train heading down to San Francisco. Arrived there July 29th. He even insisted on walking from the train to his car, trying to show he was okay, before they rushed him to the Palace Hotel.
But he relapsed at the hotel.
Yes. Suffered a relapse. The doctors now confirmed heart problems and also diagnosed pneumonia. They confined him strictly to bed, treated him with liquid caffeine and digitalis. And for a few days, he seemed to be improving again. The nation breathed a sigh of relief.
But it was temporary.
Tragically, yes. On the afternoon of August 2nd, he still seemed to be getting better. Doctors even allowed him to sit up in bed. Around 7:30 that evening, Florence was reading to him an article from the Saturday Evening Post, a flattering piece called A Calm Review of a Calm Man.
And his last words.
He apparently told Florence, "That's good. Go on, read some more." And just seconds later, he suddenly twisted convulsively and collapsed back in the bed, gasping.
Oh my gosh.
Doctors rushed in, tried to revive him, but it was too late. Warren G. Harding was pronounced dead. He was only 57.
What was the official cause of death given?
Initially, they attributed it to a cerebral hemorrhage, basically a stroke. Cardiac arrest symptoms weren't as well understood back then. And significantly, Florence Harding refused to allow an autopsy. A decision that fueled speculation for years.
His death must have shocked the country.
A huge shock. He was genuinely liked and admired, as the sources say. The public had been following his illness closely. They'd been reassured by the reports he was recovering. His sudden death hit the nation hard.
And the funeral journey was a major national event.
Immense. His body was placed in a casket, put on a train for this mournful journey back across the country to Washington, D.C. Newspapers followed every step. An estimated 9 million people lined the railroad tracks along the route just to pay their respects as the train passed.
9 million. Incredible.
Gives you a sense of his popularity at that moment. He lay in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. Then, after services in D.C., his body was taken back home to Marion, Ohio for burial.
Who attended the burial?
President Coolidge, of course, Chief Justice Taft, Florence, Harding's elderly father. And notably, giants of American industry were there. Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Harvey Firestone. A real testament to the respect he commanded, at least at the time of his death.
He and Florence are buried together in Marion now.
Yes, in the Harding tomb. It wasn't dedicated until 1931. President Herbert Hoover presided and Calvin Coolidge attended, a final resting place for a president whose reputation was about to undergo a seismic shift.
All right, this is where the story of Warren G. Harding takes that sharp, devastating turn, almost entirely after his death. We mentioned his cabinet was a mix.
Right. He appointed lots of friends and acquaintances from Ohio to federal jobs. Some were perfectly competent, like his doctor, Charles Sawyer, who actually tried to warn him about corruption. Others were just kind of ineffective political appointments.
But then there was the Ohio gang.
Yes, the Ohio gang. A group of his appointees who proved to be outright corrupt. And the crucial point here is that most of the scandals that completely destroyed Harding's reputation emerged after he died. Sources suggest he was often unaware of the illegal stuff going on, at least initially. This posthumous flood of revelations is key to understanding his legacy.
He did become aware of some corruption before he died, like in the Veterans Bureau.
Yes, he learned about major corruption in the Veterans Bureau in January 1923. But his handling of it, as one source puts it, did him little credit. He basically allowed the corrupt director, Charles R. Forbes, to resign and flee to Europe to avoid immediate scandal. Forbes did eventually come back and serve prison time, but Harding's instinct was to hush it up initially.
What about Jess Smith, Daugherty's aide?
Harding also learned that Smith was deeply involved in corruption at the Justice Department. Just before leaving on that final Western trip, Harding ordered Attorney General Daugherty to get Smith out of Washington and keep him off the trip. Shortly after, on May 30, 1923, Jess Smith committed suicide.
Did Harding know the full extent of Smith's crimes? Or Daugherty's potential involvement?
It's uncertain, according to historian Robert Murray. Murray argues Harding wasn't personally involved in the corruption and didn't approve of it, but his failure to act decisively against these figures earlier proved catastrophic for his reputation later.
And there was that conversation he had with Hoover on the Western tour, asking about what to do if you knew about a big scandal.
Right. Reportedly asked Hoover, if you knew of a great scandal in our administration, would you, for the good of the country and the party, expose it publicly? Or would you bury it? Hoover strongly advised publishing it, taking the hit but getting credit for integrity. Harding hinted the scandal involved Jess Smith, but clammed up when Hoover pressed him about Daugherty's possible role. You can feel the weight of this knowledge crushing him in those final weeks.
Okay, let's talk about the big one. The scandal that really became synonymous with Harding's administration. Teapot Dome.
Teapot Dome. It sounds almost quaint, but it was huge. It involved a government oil reserve in Wyoming called Teapot Dome, one of three set aside specifically for the Navy's future fuel needs. There had been debate for years about whether these reserves should be developed or kept pristine.
And Harding changed who controlled them.
Yes. In May 1921, Harding signed an executive order transferring control of the Teapot Dome Reserve and two others in California, Elk Hills and Buena Vista, from the Navy Department to the Department of the Interior, run by Albert B. Fall. The Navy Secretary, Edwin Denby, consented to the transfer. On the surface, maybe just seemed like bureaucratic shuffling.
But Fall had plans for those reserves.
Big plans. And secret plans. In July 1921, Fall secretly leased the drilling rights at the Elk Hills Reserve in California to an oil tycoon named Edward Doheny. No competitive bidding. Then later, a Wyoming senator, John Kendrick, found out the Teapot Dome itself had also been secretly leased.
Also without bidding.
Yes, to another oil magnate, Harry Sinclair and his Mammoth Oil Company. Again, no announcement, no competitive bids. When Senator Kendrick asked the Interior Department for the documents, they refused. That immediately raised red flags.
So the Senate got involved.
Yes, a Senate resolution forced Interior to disclose the leases. The justification given was military preparedness. Sinclair's company was supposed to build some oil storage tanks for the Navy in exchange for the drilling rights. But the secrecy and lack of bidding smelled fishy.
Conservationists were outraged.
Furious. People like Difford Pinchot demanded an investigation. Senator Robert La Follette, a progressive Republican, initiated a Senate investigation, which was eventually led by a tenacious Democratic senator from Montana, Thomas J. Walsh.
And Walsh started digging.
He did, painstakingly. He uncovered a letter from Harding himself confirming his knowledge and approval of the transfer of the reserves to Fall and the subsequent leases. The public hearings began in October 1923, a couple of months after Harding's death.
What happened at the hearings?
Fall, who had conveniently resigned from Interior earlier that year, denied taking any money. So did Sinclair and Doheny. But Senator Walsh kept digging, found evidence that Fall had suddenly started spending lavishly on his ranch back in New Mexico.
Where did Fall say the money came from?
He claimed it was a loan from Edward B. McLean, the publisher of the Washington Post and a friend of Harding's. But McLean denied giving him such a loan. Then Doheny admitted she'd given Fall $100,000 in cash, but claimed it was just a personal loan between friends. Fall eventually took the fifth when called to testify again. Very damaging.
So what did the investigation ultimately find? Bribes.
Yes. Investigators concluded that Fall and a relative had received about $400,000 in cash and bonds from Doheny and Sinclair around the same time he granted them the leases. The connection was undeniable.
And Fall was convicted.
He was. Convicted of accepting bribes in 1929. And in 1931, Albert Fall became the first U.S. cabinet member ever to go to prison for crimes committed while in office, a landmark moment in government corruption.
What about Sinclair and Doheny, the ones who paid the bribes?
Sinclair was eventually convicted, but only of jury tampering and contempt of Congress, served a short sentence. Doheny, incredibly, despite admitting giving Fall the $100,000, was acquitted by a jury in 1930.
Wow. Justice wasn't exactly even-handed there.
Not at all. But the damage was done. Teapot Dome became the ultimate symbol of the Harding administration's corruption, forever staining his name, even though the worst details emerged after his death.
And the Justice Department under Daugherty wasn't immune either.
Far from it. Daugherty's appointment itself was controversial, given his background as an Ohio lobbyist and political fixer. People immediately suspected he must have been involved in Teapot Dome, although he and Fall weren't actually close. In February 1924, the Senate voted to investigate the Justice Department itself, while Daugherty was still the Attorney General.
Who led that investigation?
Another tough Montana senator, Burton K. Wheeler. And he uncovered the dealings of Jess Smith, Daugherty's aide who had committed suicide. Smith had been running extensive influence peddling schemes out of the infamous Little Greenhouse on K Street.
Little Greenhouse, what was that?
It was literally a little greenhouse on K Street in D.C. where Smith and some associates met with people, allegedly taking payoffs from bootleggers and others seeking favors from the Justice Department. Witnesses, including Smith's ex-wife, Roxy Stinson, testified and alleged that Daugherty himself was personally involved, that he knew what Smith was doing.
What happened to Daugherty? Coolidge was president by then.
Coolidge demanded Daugherty's resignation in March 1924 when Daugherty refused to give Senate investigators access to Justice Department files. Daugherty was later indicted, along with Colonel Thomas W. Miller, who ran the Office of Alien Property Custodian.
What was the charge?
Defrauding the government in a deal involving releasing assets of a German-owned company seized during the war. Jess Smith had deposited $50,000, likely bribe money from the deal, into a joint bank account he shared with Daugherty. Conveniently, Daugherty's records for that account were destroyed.
So, did Daugherty get convicted?
No. Miller, the alien property custodian, was convicted and served prison time. But Daugherty went through two trials, and both ended in hung juries. The charges were eventually dropped. He was never convicted of anything.
But his reputation was ruined.
Absolutely devastated. His refusal to testify in his own defense, claiming he needed to protect confidential communications related to Harding, looked terrible. He spent the rest of his life blaming his troubles on his political enemies and communists. But the damage was permanent.
And then there was the Veterans Bureau scandal. You mentioned Harding knew about that one before he died.
Yes, a particularly ugly one, betraying the very soldiers Harding claimed to champion. Charles R. Forbes, the director of the Veterans Bureau, was this energetic guy who consolidated power over veterans hospitals and their construction, getting control transferred from the Treasury Department in April 1922 with Harding's support and backing from the American Legion.
His job was to build hospitals for wounded WWI vets.
Right, hundreds of thousands needed care. But Forbes immediately started running scams. He conspired with construction companies run by Elias Mortimer and Charles Hurley to give them contracts, inflating the costs massively from maybe $3,000 per hospital bed to $4,000, and then splitting the profits three ways. Some money also went to the Bureau's chief counsel, Charles Kramer.
Just skimming off the top of contracts meant for veterans.
Exactly. Graft was everywhere, even land acquisition. They bought a site near San Francisco worth less than $20,000 for $105,000, and Forbes and Kramer split $25,000 of the difference.
Unbelievable. What else?
In November 1922, Forbes started selling off vast stockpiles of valuable hospital supplies, sheets, medicines, equipment from a depot in Perryville, Maryland for pennies on the dollar to an insider firm connected to Mortimer. Meanwhile, the Veterans Bureau was buying new supplies at inflated prices. Just pure fraud.
How did it get exposed?
Dr. Sawyer, Harding's personal physician, who also chaired a federal hospital board, got wind of it. He investigated, found proof of Forbes' schemes, and presented it to Harding in January 1923.
How did Harding react?
Sources say he was shocked, alternated between rage and despondency. But his first instinct was damage control. He demanded Forbes resign immediately, but allowed him to flee to Europe first, hoping to avoid a public scandal. Forbes officially resigned February 15, 1923.
But the story got out anyway.
Gossip travels fast in Washington. The Senate launched an investigation. Kramer, the chief counsel, committed suicide in March. Mortimer, whose wife had apparently been having an affair with Forbes, turned state's evidence and became a key witness against him. Forbes eventually returned, was convicted in 1924, and served 2 years in federal prison.
And Harding's handling of it just looked bad.
Really bad. As historians Trenena and Wilson put it, one of the most troublesome aspects of the Harding presidency was that he appeared to be far more concerned with political liabilities of a scandal than in securing justice. That perception stuck.
Okay, beyond the political corruption, Harding's personal life also became fodder for scandal after his death. The extramarital affairs.
Yes. It emerged he'd had a long 15-year affair with a woman from Marion named Carrie Fulton Phillips. It ended around 1920 when he was running for president. Love letters between them were discovered decades later in 1963, kept sealed for years, finally unsealed in 2014.
And the letters were passionate.
Apparently very much so. Biographer Francis Russell, who saw them earlier, concluded Phillips was the love of Harding's life. This revelation of a serious long-term affair added another layer to the negative image.
And then there was Nan Britton.
Nan Britton, another mistress, also from Marion. She claimed Harding fathered her daughter, Elizabeth Ann Blazing. Harding always denied it, and his family long maintained he was infertile due to childhood mumps.
But DNA testing proved Britton right.
Yes. In 2015, DNA tests comparing descendants confirmed Harding was indeed Elizabeth Ann's father.
And Britton wrote a book about it.
She did. In 1927, she published The President's Daughter. It was dedicated to all unwedded mothers and became a huge bestseller, though it was considered scandalous and sold door to door by Britton herself initially.
What did the book allege?
Besides claiming Harding was the father, it included salacious details, like alleging they had sex in a coat closet right near the Oval Office. Britton actually lost a libel suit against someone who wrote a rebuttal book calling her claims lies. But many people believed her story.
And it just further dragged Harding's reputation through the mud.
Absolutely. It painted him as morally bankrupt on top of being politically incompetent or tolerant of corruption. Britton claimed Harding had secretly paid her child support about $500 a month, but said she destroyed his romantic letters to her.
It's interesting, as Sinclair noted, Grover Cleveland got elected president in 1884, even though it was known he'd fathered a child out of wedlock. Harding seemed to face a harsher judgment.
It does seem that way. Maybe the times had changed. Maybe the combination of political and personal scandals was just too much. Or maybe, for whatever reason, Harding just wasn't afforded the same leeway. It raises questions about how we judge historical figures and whether those standards are applied consistently.
So let's recap the trajectory of Harding's reputation. Immediately after he died, huge outpouring of grief, widespread admiration.
Absolutely. Deeply mourned, not just in the U.S., but internationally, too. European papers called him a man of peace. American journalists wrote glowing tributes, some saying he literally gave his life for his country. The first biographies were pure hagiography, like Joe Mitchell Chappell's Life and Times of Warren G. Harding, our after-war president in 1924, just pure praise.
But that admiration evaporated incredibly quickly.
Almost overnight. As the scandal started breaking Teapot Dome, the Veterans Bureau, Jess Smith's suicide, the narrative flipped completely. Harding administration rapidly became shorthand for corruption and incompetence.
And books published in the late 20s really cemented that negative view.
They did. William Allen White's Masks in a Pageant just skewered him. Samuel Hopkins Adams wrote a fictionalized but clearly based on Harding novel called Revelry that depicted his time as one of utter presidential weakness. It was a sensation.
And Nan Britton's book added the personal sleaze factor.
Right. The President's Daughter came out in 1927, further damaging his public image. Even his successor, Calvin Coolidge, wanted nothing to do with him publicly. Coolidge refused to dedicate the Harding tomb in Marion.
Hoover eventually did it.
Hoover did in 1931. But by then, Hoover himself was deeply unpopular because of the Great Depression, so it didn't exactly rehabilitate Harding's image. And Samuel Hopkins Adams wasn't done of him. He kept writing about Harding, culminating in his 1939 biography, The Incredible Era, The Life and Times of Warren G. Harding, where he famously called Harding an amiable, well-meaning, third-rate Mr. Babbitt.
A Babbitt. Like the Sinclair Lewis character.
Exactly. Just sort of a mediocre, conformist, boosterish, small-town businessman completely out of his depth. That image really stuck, became the dominant historical verdict for decades.
But some later historians felt this was unfair. Too unbalanced.
Yes. John Dean, who wrote a biography of Harding much later, argued that those early accounts by White and Adams were remarkably unbalanced and unfair, just exaggerating all the negatives, blaming Harding for everything, giving him zero credit for any successes. But Dean admits, yet the myth has persisted.
When did historians start taking a fresh look? Was it when his papers were opened?
That was a turning point, yes. Harding's personal papers were finally opened to researchers in 1964. That sparked a new wave of biographies. Francis Russell's The Shadow of Blooming Grove came out in 1968. It was controversial, arguing those old rumors about Black ancestry deeply affected Harding psychologically.
Were there more positive interpretations too?
Robert K. Murray's The Harding Era in 1969 took a much more positive view. Murray tried to place Harding in the context of his times, highlighting the policy achievements. Though some critics, like Traney and Wilson, felt Murray maybe gave Harding too much credit for the successes of his talented cabinet members.
And then even more revisionist takes later on.
Yeah. In the 90s and 2000s, Robert Farrell's The Strange Deaths of President Harding, 1996, explicitly challenged almost everything that had become accepted wisdom about Harding. John Dean's 2004 biography was also seen as highly revisionist, maybe sometimes downplaying the negative bits, but trying to offer a strong counter-narrative.
Others still focused on his perceived weaknesses.
Right. Historian Eugene Trani, for instance, attributed Harding's failures primarily to his own lack of depth and decisiveness, suggesting it was more about character flaws than just bad luck or bad friends. So the debate continues.
And Harding consistently ranks near the bottom in those presidential ranking polls historians do.
Consistently. Often dead last, or very close to it. He was ranked last out of 29 presidents in a famous Harvard poll back in 1948.
Why do some historians think he ranks so poorly? Is it just the scandals?
Well, Farrell argued it's because too many scholars rely on those early sensational accounts instead of digging into the primary sources. Another historian, Coffey, argued that a general academic lack of interest in Harding has cost him his reputation. For a long time, maybe it was just easier for historians to accept the worst president ever narrative than to grapple with the complexities.
But that's changing. There's a really reassessment underway.
There definitely is in recent decades. Some scholars are looking beyond the scandals at the actual policies and outcomes. That book, The Spoils of War, 2016, used quantitative measures and ranked Harding first among presidents for having the fewest wartime deaths combined with the highest per capita income growth during his term. A really provocative finding based on his economic record and keeping the U.S. out of conflict.
Highlighting the economic boon and the period of peace.
Exactly. Robert Murray argued Harding deserves more credit than historians have given, putting him on par with presidents like Franklin Pierce, Andrew Johnson, Benjamin Harrison, maybe even Calvin Coolidge. Murray stated Harding's administration had concrete accomplishments that were superior to a sizable portion of those in the nation's history.
But Murray also acknowledged the flip side, the responsibility.
Crucially, yes. Murray pointed out that in our system, the president isn't just an innocent bystander. Harding gets to claim credit for the successes of Hughes and Hoover, but he also must shoulder responsibility for a Daugherty injustice and a fall in Interior. And he has to bear the blame for his lack of punitive action against corrupt officials like Forbes and Smith.
So his inaction sealed his fate, reputation-wise.
Murray argues that Harding's inaction forfeited his chance for a positive historical image. It made the negative verdict inevitable, if not wholly deserved. It's a really nuanced take, acknowledging the achievements, but also the profound failures of leadership, especially in holding his own administration accountable. It leaves us with a much more complex and still debated legacy. #outro.
So we've journeyed through this truly remarkable and ultimately quite tragic story of Warren G. Harding, a man who climbed from being a small town Ohio newspaperman right to the very highest office in the land.
Ushered in that era of normalcy, presided over significant economic recovery and growth.
Only to have his legacy completely consumed, really, by personal scandals and the shocking corruption of people he put into power, people he trusted, almost all of it exploding after his sudden death.
And what really stands out is that dramatic swing in how history has viewed him, from being arguably one of the most beloved presidents at the moment he died.
Right. Those 9 million people lining the tracks.
Exactly. To becoming, for decades, almost a caricature of presidential failure and scandal. But now, as new information comes out, like his papers finally being opened, and as historians take a fresh look, a more nuanced picture is starting to emerge. Still deeply flawed, absolutely, but more complex.
And a powerful lesson, isn't it? About how historical judgments aren't always permanent.
Definitely. And why does this matter to you, listening? Well, Harding's story is just such a potent reminder of how complicated leadership is, how much personal choices can impact public office, and how our collective memory of history isn't fixed. It's constantly evolving as we learn more.
It really challenges us to look beyond the easy headlines, the conventional wisdom, right? To actually engage with all the facts, not just the simple sensational narratives.
Absolutely. So here's a final provocative thought to leave you with. Consider this: if the full details, the sheer scale of Keypot Dome, the Veterans Bureau fraud, if Harding's affairs, if all that had become public knowledge during his lifetime, or maybe what if he had lived longer, lived to confront those scandals directly, maybe take decisive action, fire people, prosecute them.
How different would things have been?
Exactly. How might the path of his presidency, maybe even American history, have been different? What does that tell us about that fine line between what's known publicly and what stays hidden, and the enduring power of secrets and their eventual revelation to shape a leader's ultimate place in history? Something to think about.